Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 6, 1996. In the fireside room this evening, our speaker is Ann Peterson. Today's session number is 7 and is titled, Where You Stand Determines What You See. Let's listen in.
And this session is part of the Us and Them series entitled, Where You Stand Determines What You See. I'm going to give just a brief little introduction again. Some of you I recognize from, was that yesterday? This week has just drifted. Time, I can't sort of keep one meal from one day, from one part of it separate. We began a series yesterday entitled Us and Them. Yesterday the question was, in order to have an us, do we need to have a them? And we spent some time in the session just sort of looking at sort of polarities that occur in our culture. Rich and poor, old and young, sort of, and then tried to describe the dynamics about what made somebody them. And then tried to wrestle with, at the end of the session, a little bit, a question that I think is going to keep running through all the sessions this week, which is, how do we talk about the divisions that occur in our life, which I think become both problem and promise? How do we talk about this great array of diversity that we have in our world and see it both as problematic, as fearful, as threatening, and also as hopeful and celebrative? And the second level question of that is, what do we do with the scripture passages? And I'll read a little bit more of this in length later, but like from Galatians 3:28, there is neither male nor female, slave nor free, Jew nor Greek, but all are one in Christ Jesus. And of course, that's rooted in prior baptism language, which really has to do with the theme of this whole summer, water washed and spirit born. And supposedly baptism is that sacrament, and same with the Eucharist, which brings us together, which unifies us, and makes those us-thems, particularly when they're hierarchical or over against each other, soften into a both-and, and where we become unified. Tomorrow, the session in the morning will particularly be focusing on the sacraments. I've titled The Body of Christ Broken for You, looking at how we practice the sacraments and how the church really has become divided along lines of sacramental practices, and how that determines sort of how we look at the faith. The underlying text again for this week, and I've been told I did a good job at the bookstore again because they're gone. He's supposed to get in an order later this week, but if you have time to pick it up, I think he said they might be in tomorrow. More copies of Ole Rolvag's book, Their Father's God, which again is a story about Susan Doheny, a young Irish Catholic girl who marries Peter Holm, the Lutheran Norwegian, and the ensuing conflicts in their marriage. Has anybody picked it up and started it? Okay. All right.
Read it.
Oh, read it. Oh, lovely ending, isn't it?
Oh, charming.
Yeah. But the marriage is sort of becomes a microcosm or a metaphor for the conflicts that ensue in this community, and how these two are perceived by their relatives and friends and neighbors, and how they're able to raise their son in the middle of this. And of course, it's the sacrament of baptism, as I mentioned before, which becomes the divisive element in the story that sort of rips the families apart. At the beginning of the book, the scene opens up with an incredible drought in South Dakota. There's been no rain for days and days and days. And finally, as the book progresses, the grandmother, Barrett, finally has decided that this young grandson of hers has to be baptized. So finally, she and her friend Serena sneak off and baptize the young child to be Lutheran, so God forbid he wouldn't end up Catholic. So she baptizes him in secret, and of course the next day it rains. So there's this immediate connection in Barrett's mind between the rain and the baptism of this young boy. Down a bit through the story, of course, Susie becomes concerned that the child hasn't been baptized. And unbeknownst to the Lutheran half of the relatives, the Roman Catholic side, and also with different names, Pater Emmanuel, I think, was the Lutheran name, and then the Catholic one has slipped.
Patrick.
But Patrick Olaf. Patrick St. Olaf, or some crazy combination. Anyway, that becomes the Catholic baptism. And so that sort of sets up a dramatic tension as the family begins to find out that each side had betrayed each other with the very sacrament that was to bring them together. And I'm not going to give away the ending of the book until probably tomorrow or later in the week, because I think it's an important, hopefully you can kind of find it out on your own. But tomorrow we'll talk a little bit more about the conflicts that we see in the church, the body of Christ being an image not only for the Eucharist, but the body of Christ is also an image for how we live together as community. Paul's image that we all belong to one body. And at least in this book, this is a very fractured, hurting body. Now, I'm not sure it's all that different than some of the congregations and families we talk about. Just a couple little paragraphs I wanted to read from it. This is Peter's brother who's describing this marriage, and he says, "Every place I go, people pounce on me, asking me how the Nordling is getting along with his little Irish wife. They all grin wickedly, want to know how it feels to be related to a lot of Catholics, how much the Pope is taxing you." You've disgraced the whole family, that's what you've done. Okay? So Peter's family begins to let Peter know that in no uncertain circumstances, marrying across this boundary of us and them has disgraced the entire family, and he's ashamed of his brother. And then not too far down the road is another sort of ironic passage. Peter finds himself talking to a bunch of the people in the community about prejudice. This book is really a commentary on how we get along with those who we find as them. And he says, "Here we are, a big prairie full of people gathered from all parts of the earth. Tor from Norway, Dennis from Ireland, some of us have sprung up right out of the sod. No matter where we've come from, we all have the same job, to push together for the goal that humankind has been seeking ever since it was morning the first day. Our task is here to build up a happiness so great and so wonderful that the glory of it will brighten up the far corners of the world. But before we can hope to reach that goal, we've got to clear the road of a lot of worm-eaten barriers. I mean all those silly superstitions and prejudices," which is of course what he calls his wife's practice of the Catholic faith, "should have been dumped into the sea centuries ago. These prairies will never be beautiful until we finish that job. Isn't that right?" And then there's pages and pages of commentary on sort of how he struggles with the intense prejudice in his community about this marriage. And of course, to complicate it, they had to get married early. Susie was pregnant. So there's this whole sort of scandal about the marriage in the first place. Even more threatening that it's crossed these incredible borders from how they get along with each other. I mentioned yesterday, the Norwegians are the clean and tidy ones, the Irish are the dirty ones, and they have boiled food and fried food. They have fried food and the Norwegians eat boiled food. And you know, there's all these distinctions that mark how they see each other in opposite ways. I want to talk just a little bit about, I sort of, three parts of the evening. The first is to talk a little bit about, I'm not going to spend much time on it because it's rather dry material, but I think it's sort of interesting. I'm also not a philosopher, so I don't want to get myself in over my head. But I think it helps to talk a little bit about, in our culture, there's a tension, at least I pick it up politically and socially all the time, about working for universal goals. Things that apply to all people, truth that we talk about is universal, and yet this incredible tension with the diversity that we experience. And a sort of the firm, you often hear people say, "Well, all the things I once held to be true were falling out from under me. The center doesn't seem to be holding anymore." Things that we once felt were true and good and right about our culture seem to be slipping away. So what is that all about? And one description of that, I think, is to talk about this transition, and maybe you've heard it. It describes everything from music to philosophy to literature, is this movement that we call the transition from the modern world to the postmodern world, or the Enlightenment to the post-Enlightenment. But talk just briefly about that to sort of locate the discussion about where we'll move with this little phrase, "where you stand determines what you see." My writing is probably not at its best. My students let me know that all the time, so I'll try to explain what I've written up here. But I just drew a division between the modern or the Enlightenment world and what we might talk about as the postmodern world. And these are just, any time you try to draw a typology and sort of set things up, you risk oversimplification. But in general, the Enlightenment is that period of time that began after the Scientific Revolution during the 17th and 18th centuries, which carried over into our country from Europe. You think of people's names like Gottfried Leibniz, John Locke, Descartes, the philosophers or minds who sort of formed the ideas out of which really our country was sort of birthed. And those ideas should sound fairly familiar to you, like commitment to reason as the proper tool for determining authority. In other words, human reason became the way to determine issues of authority because it was an attempt to overturn what had been the authority, which is, of course, the church. Through the Reformation and up through the Scientific Revolution, the church had been sort of the center of authority and the center, really, of history for this part of the world, for Western Europe. By the time the Scientific Revolution sort of takes shape, the Enlightenment grows, humans become sort of the center stage and replace the church. And rationality, you might even say common sense, becomes the arbiter for making decisions about truth. There's also a stress then on empirical or scientific method for reasoning. There's still a sense, and it's a sharp division. In our college at Augustana, there's still a sense in which the natural science division does the real work at describing reality, and the humanities sort of does that soft stuff, the soft core knowledge. You even think about it when you try to get funding. How many times have anybody here in the humanities? How many of you get large grants for research? Yeah. Whereas the sciences, with the true way of determining things, and of course I realize it's a crass characterization of the scientific method, but I think in popular culture, we still assume that science has led us to the way we know reality. Another characteristic of the Enlightenment is progress. The present is always an improvement on the past. It's an attempt to move beyond tradition, to say that we're getting better and better. Along with it, I think, goes a certain optimism about the human spirit and human capabilities. A fourth characteristic I put up here is individualism, the sense that reason and personal experience become the criteria for determining truth. I still hear a lot of conversations in classrooms that if it's my experience and my truth, then it's true for everybody. Or the way I make up my mind is by my personal preference. I think a lot of us still sort of ferret out truth or how we decide things solely based on personal preference. Christianity, in a sense, became wrapped up in this. Personal experience and individual decision become sort of the way one experiences the piety of the faith. And a fifth characteristic I put down is universal truth. That is, there was an assumption or building a sort of timeless, valid body of truth that applied to all the world. And that the process of getting to the truth was to get at this sort of objective body of knowledge. And of course, at least for Christianity, it was assumed that Christianity was the universal truth that applied to all the world. And you can sort of see, another one that I could have added down here is that ignorance is a form of evil. Because how do we try to overcome evil in our world? We educate people. If there are problems, we assume that education can overcome ignorance, which I think has often been a form of expression of, maybe not evil, but... So those characteristics, I think, sort of describe in sort of a general way how we've inherited our tradition in this country, and particularly the Western European thought that has influenced American culture. Can you see there the sort of what I would call piety for sure foundations, for truth that is out there that applies to everybody? The fact that there's progress, that the human is capable of doing great things in this transition of, I'm not going to argue whether we're really postmodern people or not. I hear arguments that we're now in the postmodern world. Other people say we're still modern, we're not quite yet postmodern. I don't know that that matters, but you can see some of the critiques that have become part of our culture now. For instance, there's been a recovery of the aesthetic or of emotion and beauty as a way to discern what's true in the world. It's not just reason that gets us to where we're going, but also the experience of the beautiful and the sublime and the aesthetic. We've become disillusioned with science and technology. It's clear that it complicates our lives as much as it brings solutions to the world. Particularly during this week when we talk about the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it's clear that science and technology, which once was thought to be sort of the answer to the world's problems, has also complicated our lives. That kind of moves into the third characteristic about the optimism, that progress, that we're getting better and better all the time. Anybody, I think, who's lived through the World Wars, through Vietnam, experienced such incredible loss and tragedy that our culture really has never recovered from that. When you look at the devastation, we're sort of, many people define us instead of postmodern as post-Holocaust. Okay, the sort of devastation that occurred in World War II. There's also, in a positive way, again, a recovery of the social, of the fact that we're not just individual, isolated people, and that truth is not just how I personally understand it, but that it becomes through an interactive corporate process. And finally, this is the piece that we're going to look most at tonight, that truth or truths are not necessarily universal, but socially located. In other words, where you've come out of will determine how you understand truth in the world. And truth is less like gaining that body of abstract knowledge out there, but more like a process of discovery with others, learning from other people's stances in life, how you begin to discover what reality is, what truth is. Okay? So these are helpful for me to just sort of locate or describe what I think philosophically, politically, and socially has shaped the way the church understands itself in the 1990s. Comments or questions on this? Yeah, Karen?
Yeah, I like what you have. I would just add also to the enlightened, the modern mm-hmm. side of it. A kind of desire to manage things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think a lot of the, bureaucratic, mm-hmm. let's manage it, let's bring it under control, under human control, okay. Which I think operates in the church too, mm-hmm. As opposed to the diversity of mm-hmm. stuff that happens on the right hand side there. That can't be readily managed at times.
So the notion of control and management is the way things get done. And it is that sense of human control that we have the ability to sort of put things into place and control them. And that's helpful. Other things that you think should be up there or that you're thinking about is. Does this stuff sound familiar? Does it ring somewhat true that we're kind of caught between these two places? And that the sort of craving for universal truth and timeless meaning, things that apply to everyone, the hope for optimism, and I think that goes with this desire to control and manage. What we're finding out is that because life is so socially constructed and truth is not so easy to come at, life has become sort of out of control. I think that can also be very hopeful. But it does mean that there's a certain restlessness or what I would call dis-ease that we often culturally express. So I think the fear is, what do we do with all this diversity and these differences? Where's our culture heading? Are we going to become so fragmented that we fall apart? Any comments at this point? Okay, what I'd like to do is move into what I would call sort of a constructive piece, talking about how actually this side of the board can be very positive, looking at the little phrase, where you stand determines what you see. If I quote you to death, let me know. This is a very brief quote from Kathleen Norris, whose book, again, I'll recommend if you haven't picked it up. It's Reflections and Essays on Living in the Dakotas. But much broader than that, it's really a metaphor for her rediscovery of her spiritual life, particularly among the Benedictines. And she has just a one-paragraph reflection here on conversion. What happens when one is converted? And she equates it with discovering where you've come from. She says conversion means starting with who we are, not who we wish we were. It means knowing where we come from. It means taking to the heart the words of a Native American writer, Andy Smith, who writes, "A true medicine woman would advise a white woman to look into her own culture and find out what's liberating in it." And this is what I hope I have done by moving back to Dakota. My path of conversion may have a few elements of Indianness because of the spirits of the land where I live, and because I understand that my faith comes from my grandmother's. It was in moving back to the plains that I have found my old ones, my flesh and blood ancestors, as well as the desert monks and mystics of the Christian church. Dakota is where it all comes together, and surely that is one definition of the sacred. So for her, where she stands determines what she seeks. You can take in a sense that coming back to the land in which her ancestors, her grandparents, raised her and her family, coming back to the actual geography that shaped those people, in a sense, has led to a spiritual conversion for her. It's coming home. I've often thought, you know, there's the old phrase, you can't go home again. And yet, there's so much about the area that has shaped who we are. And that leads to, I think, the formation of our own identity. Just out of curiosity, kind of get a feeling for where people are. Iowa, since I know there are a few in here, okay? Where else?
Wisconsin?
Washington? Montana?
Maryland?
Okay. Mm-hmm. East Coast?
Minnesota?
Chicago? Pennsylvania? Okay. The landscapes that I think shape and sort of nourish who we are, being born and raised in Montana. I have a good friend who's serving a parish in Minnesota right now, and she and I've talked about the way that I don't think we realized how deeply growing up in southern Montana has influenced the way we understand everything. The way we experienced, we used to lead backpacks out in Montana, and after she delivered her first child, or when she was in the process of labor, my friend Peggy said the nurse asked her, "Isn't this the most awful thing you've ever done?" And she said, "No. Leading those backpacks was a whole lot worse." And that may be not true for all women, but Peggy remembers the incredible physical challenge of the sort of land, much like the landscape around here, of being out on the trail and leading groups, and sort of how that landscape has influenced. And after spending a whole week last week on Norman McLean, I think that sort of shaping of finding out the geography of who you are, and we're going to take a lot more time with this later, but where you come from will determine what you see. So you can take that in sort of a literal way. The geography leads of one's life leads one, I think, to a discovery of their spiritual core. And of course, what that does is if you've moved from one landscape to another, you begin to appreciate what it's like to be in another geographical region. It has taken me a long time, still is taking me a long time, to learn to love the prairie. But I have friends who grew up in the Dakota prairies for whom that's the most beautiful place in the world. One is a wild, has his degree in wildlife management, and they've taken us out into the prairie, and Ross knows every duck, every bird that flies in the sky, all the different flowers. What to me looked like a bunch of grass and a few birds flying began to have names and began to make some sort of connection. And over the years, all the fields of corn and soybeans and stuff have begun to sort of feel like home. And discovered that landscape has begun to sort of nourish who we are. For one thing, you can see forever. And I've begun to sort of appreciate that. that boundary that extends itself. But I think it does help to move into other people's locations. Moving to the south side of Chicago was an enormous transition for my husband and myself. Just the sort of rhythm of Hyde Park. Remember about the first 6 months, every time we went out, there were people on the street. It didn't seem to matter what time of night it was, and things were open. Bookstores till midnight. I'd never heard of such a thing. And then when we moved back to Sioux Falls, it was really quiet. Nothing was open past 10, and everybody went in their house and shut themselves up, and nobody walked the streets at night. And ironically, about the first year in Sioux Falls, I felt less safe there than I did in Hyde Park because there was nobody out there. If you got into trouble, who'd find you? So, I don't know, as you enter into other people's geography or landscape, you begin to understand the place literally from which they've come. And of course, the problem in Roldog's book is that that never really happens. This sort of entering into each other's spaces. Another little quote from a book that I used a lot in freshman religion class called Getting to Yes, Negotiate an Agreement Without Giving In. It's actually put out by the Harvard Business School. And it was our first text for the first 2 weeks of freshman religion, which had to do with how does one talk about difference? And this is a little conversation about location. Where you stand determines what you see. Put yourself in their shoes. This is written out of an experience of business transactions, which I think is really interesting. How you see the world depends on where you sit. People tend to see what they want to see. The ability to see the situation as the other side sees it, as difficult as it may be, is one of the most important skills a negotiator can possess. So it's crossing these boundaries of us and them. How does one negotiate the borders of difference? It is not enough to know that they see things differently. If you want to influence them, you also need to understand empathetically the power of their point of view. That's an interesting little piece to me. It's not just enough that you sort of say, well, yeah, I can get into your space and I sort of see what life is about, but what's the power behind their view? That's an important correlation. And to feel the emotional force with which they believe in it. Understanding their point of view is not the same as agreeing with it. It's not calling, you don't have to agree with people in order to try to get at their perspective. It is true that a better understanding of their thinking may lead you to revise your own ideas about the merits of a situation. But that is not a cost of understanding their point of view. It is always a benefit. Okay? So this transaction of getting into other people's shoes, this quote reminds us, is not just about seeing things from their perspective, but understanding the power out of which it came, and then being able to see that your views, of course, may change. How often in conversation with someone else, when you engage in a person who's different, do you begin after seeing through their glasses, your own views usually change. And for this author, the attempt to talk about these radical differences of us and them is that one can begin to see this as a possibility for promise, for looking at things beneficially. Any comments, questions? Yes?
Something that I think speaks to that, I heard a twist on the golden rule. Instead of do unto others as you would have them do unto you, it's do unto others as they would have you do unto them. So first you have to come at what would they want?
That is a big difference, isn't it? Yeah. That's exactly what this is getting at. That's very helpful. Yeah, you really have to stop and think twice if you took it from that perspective. Okay. The last little bit of time we have together is going to be to think through this little phrase, where you stand determines what you see, along with a couple other little phrases. I've stolen two things. One is the use of a biblical passage I want to just read briefly to you, and the other one, and I have some copies, so I'll try to leave in the resource center. Our campus pastor, I think, is one of the finest preachers I've ever heard, and it's always hard to take somebody else's sermon and sort of leave it in the pile, but I'll do that for you anyway, because I'm just plagiarizing his ideas. I told Steve Wolfile that I think his comments are helpful. This was a sermon that he preached, I think, about 3-4 years ago, Some of you may be familiar, in the upper Midwest, there are five Norwegian colleges, Luther, Augsburg, Concordia, St. Olaf, and Augustana. And every year, one of the five colleges hosts the International Peace Prize for them. It's really kind of an exciting event. It's a time when the Nobel laureates from that year are invited to the campus as speakers. And the five colleges come together and host an event to celebrate the Peace Prize Forum. And it's all kinds of speakers and people, mostly some incredible international speakers. Next year, Augustana will host it, and we're having the Pugwash Society, which Joseph Rotblat, as kind of the ones coming in to set up issues of science and technology and peace. But the year the sermon was written was the year of 1992, so I guess that's 4 years ago, when that was the 500th year of the discovery of 450th year. My mind is going blank. When did Columbus discover? 500 years after Columbus discovered America. That was also the celebration of that event. And it was in February when the Peace Prize Forum was held on Augustana's campus, and two former students who became rather known throughout the upper Midwest and the Rocky Mountain areas for their artwork decided to put up one of the pieces of art that they had put in Denver. That summer before Denver was to have a, have some of you heard the story at all? Denver was to have a big celebration about the discovery of America by Columbus, and some of the Native American communities became upset. So what these two men did was to help the Native American communities, and they cut, I don't know how many lodgepole pines, and constructed teepee frames. They didn't put the actual teepee around, but just constructed the frames in this large park in downtown Denver. And I forget how many of these different teepee sites that they set up as sort of a not-so-subtle protest that this discovery of America can be seen in a different way. So these teepees were set up, and I guess, I can't remember the whole outcome of this, but it caused quite a stir. In fact, I think the parade might have come to a standstill. But it caused all kinds of controversy, so they decided to bring some of these same teepees to Augustana, and I've never forgotten the scene. We got up that February morning and looked out over the landscape of Augustana, which in the center of the campus is a fairly large open area, and they'd set up these charred teepee frames. It was very important. They were charred teepee sites. And a light snow had come in and blanketed the campus and sort of fogged it in. So when you walked across the campus, you got this eerie, eerie feeling that something had been there. And it was this incredible experience of a subtle form of protest about how we would talk about peace, given the incredible tension in the Dakotas between Native American and white communities. So it was a very visual piece. And out of this came a sermon by our campus pastor called Natives and Newcomers. How do we see this different event? And he based the sermon on the passage from Matthew 25, 31 to 46. And I'm going to read that again for you. And I want you to think about it this time with the phrase, where you stand determines what you see. Where you stand determines what you see. Just listen. I'll try not to make this too long. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations will be gathered before them, and he will separate people from one another, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will put the sheep at his right hand and the goats at the left. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, come, you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was in prison, and you visited me. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry and gave you food, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? And when was it that we saw you a stranger and welcomed you, or naked and gave you clothing? And when was it that we saw you sick or in prison and visited you? And the king will answer him, truly I tell you, just as you did it to the least of these who are members of my family, you did it to me. Then he will say to those at his left hand, You that are accursed, depart from me into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me. Naked, and you did not give me clothing. Sick and in prison, and you did not visit me. Then they also will answer, Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry or thirsty or in prison, naked or a stranger, and did not take care of you? And he will answer them, truly I tell you, just as you did not do it to the least of these, you did not do it for me. And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. Where you stand determines what you see. As you thought about that passage with that little phrase, what came to your mind? Anything?
That even God separated people between us and them.
Okay. There's a certain division in this passage, isn't it? Between an us and a them.
Okay. We remember a couple of years ago, Fred Nader was doing a Bible study here, and he said, after the judgment, what do the sheep think about the goats? Don't they want to go save them?
Interesting question. Okay.
That's what came to my life when you were reading that.
What do the sheep think about the goats? Do they want to go save them?
What does that phrase, the least of these, who are the least of these?
Okay. Who are the least of these? There's sort of a definition in the text, but we need to ask that of ourselves. Who are the least of these? And from what place does one stand as the least of these?
Yes. And what if I am the least of these and I don't feel that I can do those things that get me into the sheep side?
Okay. So what if you have no power, no ability as one of the least of these?
To do those things.
That's a good point. Any other sort of perspectives? Did you find yourself on one side of the sheep or the goats? Maybe both? In some way, we're all part of the least of these, and in some ways, we're probably also part of the other side. That text, I'm not a biblical scholar, but that text always sort of frames an interesting question about how you describe us and them. And from which place you become sheep or goats, okay? So the three phrases that this sermon developed was who we listen to determines what we hear, where we stand, determines what we see. And the third one I never get quite right. I think it's what we do determines who we are. Yep. What we do determines who we are. Who we listen to determines what we hear. These are really simple phrases, aren't they? They seem so blatantly obvious. I mean, I could give a whole sermon out of that. And yet, when you begin to think of it, my ears are pretty selective. Or the problem with this is, what if you can't hear the voices because they don't have one? It's very difficult to try to listen to the voices if there's no voice there, or it's been silenced. To whom shall we listen? And what he's going back to in this text is, who do we listen to? Do we listen to the least of these, or do we listen to the other voices? Who we listen to determines what we hear. Think about... Every night when we try to watch, I think it's at 10:30, Jay Leno comes on, and we have to, and this is going to give you my prejudice, we flip by Rush Limbaugh. You know, it's like a voice that no matter how hard I try to hear, I just have to get on to the other side. And think about those voices in your life that you turn on. You know, there are some voices that I cannot listen to. So it will determine, in a sense, what you hear. One of the most difficult things for me is to try to listen to those voices that I don't want to hear, whether it's to the left or right or up or down or over against who I am. And the conversation in Their Father's God just disintegrates through the book. I ran it. Were you the one buying That's Not What I Meant?
No.
Yeah. Deborah Tannen's book, That's Not What I Meant, has a phrase in there that's wonderful. It's called complementary schismogenesis. Meaning, the more you talk over somebody, the louder the other person gets louder and louder, and the other person may get... We have two good friends of ours. One is a Norwegian, here it goes back to the same issue, Norwegian, quiet, soft-spoken man, married to an Irish-Italian wife. So when they get in arguments, her voice gets louder and louder, and the hand gestures get wilder and wilder, and you can slowly see Phil backing into the corner, becoming more and more quiet. And what that quote in Tannen talks about is that you become unable to listen to the voice of the other because you cannot hear what they're saying. And part of that, of course, is you have your own agenda. Your own voice becomes the one you're listening to, not the person to whom you're supposed to be talking. And that's the tragedy in this book, is that Peter and Susie, the initial conversations in the book, there's some indication that they really love each other. And they're trying to work things out. But the book escalates, and so does this conversation pattern. It's what Tannen is talking about. It just gets crazier and crazier. Until finally, in the end, they don't hear each other at all. So on the one hand, I think that phrase is so just incredibly obvious. But it calls us to mind from both the perspective of the text that I just read and from this issue of us and them. Call to, in your own mind, those voices that you have a hard time listening to. Whether it's the Rush Limbaughs or the voices of, you know, whatever and in whatever capacity, it becomes difficult what we hear. The second phrase, where we stand determines what we see. I work with in science and religion periodically, and I'm currently working with a neurophysiologist whose specialty is how we see. And we sat and listened to a presentation of his that will talk about what a fly sees and what a human sees when they see a flower. These great examples. Flies will see lots of little tiny dots, or a bee will see just little, you know, sort of what we construct is the whole flower. And so it was this conversation about how evolution has shaped patterns of the way we see the world. And what he's saying is that the religious human being has been shaped because we're able to see holes where other creatures are only able to see parts. It's this magnificent sort of biological construction about how we see the world. And I thought about that as this little phrase. We're thinking of doing a roadshow. I'll do the where you stand determines what you see, and he'll do the what we see determines where we stand. Because you can reverse that phrase, I think, in the same way. Again, the place from which you're coming from opens up or closes the stance in which you come from. For example, how many women are afraid to walk alone at night in their communities? How many men are? Okay, not as many hands. That's an example, I think, a little bit of where you're coming from will determine sort of what you see. It seems to be no matter where I am, I'm still afraid to be alone at night. Even the three blocks between our campus and our house, I don't feel at ease. And my husband thinks nothing of walking those three blocks over the campus to get me, to bring me home. Be vulnerable. And I think it's because of the socialization of the way I've been raised with that, but also just statistics indicate that kind of sort of fear about one's stance in life. Lots of things can determine where you come from. Kathleen Norris put it in sort of geographical and then metaphorical language. Age, the older you get, the different, you know, I heard, my mind is really going. Mark? Twain? No. Yeah, Mark, talking about how he heard part of this taper had, we told him he should get a tape of the first time he interpreted the Robert Frost poems because it has changed so much since he was here last. Mm-hmm. And you think about how things evolve over time and how your mind changes. Whether you're male or female, that's an obvious one. Deborah Tanlin spends a lot of time in her book talking about gender differences and how some of that has just been the way we've been trained will determine our conversation pattern. Sexual orientation. All those kinds of what I would call locational factors determine what you see. And of course, it's very difficult, isn't it, to engage somebody else's what I would call standpoint. How do you step in somebody's shoes? And the point of the sermon becomes not that we can't ultimately experience somebody else's standpoint, but even taking the time to walk across and listen to that standpoint can be a big risk. The gay-lesbian issue has been hot and current and important on Augustana's campus since I have been there. This last year, the campus pastor made signs for the campus community of a safe zone so that offices would have this marked across the campus where gay and lesbian students or people with gay and lesbian friends or family would feel comfortable entering a faculty member's office. And I know in our department, I think about 4 out of the 6 offices had those. But it's interesting, the whole English department, there was a safe zone sign on both ends of the hallway. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting stand. They came together as a department and decided that the whole department felt the same stance, that it was, they didn't necessarily all agree together about how they perceived the issue, but they felt that this place, this hallway, would be a safe spot, a safe place from which students, faculty could begin to discuss and experience that issue. It was a little shaming to the religion department, but anyway.
Did that bring about divisiveness, though, with the faculty of those who did and those who didn't?
Amazingly not, in sort of a strange way. Our campus, I mean, there was some discussion, you know, and it was an especially big issue over in the athletic department, mm-hmm. whether even be a safe spot. Particularly for women athletes, and I say that more out of my experience of working with some female athletes on our campus, of hearing comments of some coaches saying, "No, we sure don't want any dykes playing for our basketball team," loud enough so that, you know, young women who are struggling and young men with sexuality, and finding whether or not even the coaches, and amazingly enough, a couple of the safe zone signs appeared over there. Interestingly, first of all, on the secretary's desk. She's the one that sort of became the safe place out of which a few other people participated in that. It did become a bit divisive in the sense of who has one and who doesn't and who should and who shouldn't. But it became a way of marking solidarity, concern, compassion for those people who needed those safe spots. I mentioned a couple nights ago the incident in Billings, Montana, where there was a lot of violence done against the Jewish community in Billings, and what sign did they place but the menorah? Mm-hmm. Christians joined with, so it was that same sort of, you know, I'm going to say I'm part of safe with this community. And we had, over a number of weeks, forums in which the national head of the gay and lesbian coalition spoke at Augustana, spoke in my religion class. That caused all kinds of, you know, controversy. It was fine if they did it over in the chapel or sort of a public forum, but when they came to the honors freshman religion section, and a lot of students said, you know, that's the first time I've ever heard a gay person talk publicly. Some of the students had never, at least in their mind, encountered that. And 90% of the students went away and said things like, "Oh, he was just a real person. Wasn't he fun to talk with? I learned a lot." Some of the students still had different ideas. There was vast difference in the room about how to understand issues of sexual preference. But what it did was embody, or what I call locate, put a stance, put a body, put a face that the students couldn't back away from. This was a human being talking to them. And I think it really changed the dynamics. We have a faculty member come out publicly this year in a sermon on campus. It was published in the student newsletter, which was really interesting. The student paper had something like, "Come to chapel on Wednesday," title of the sermon, something about coming out, and so, but no name. So the whole campus was buzzing all week about who this person would be. And it actually was one of the more moving, and the first two people to stand up, he got a standing ovation after his sermon, and the first two people up out of their seats were the president and the academic dean. Which, talk about taking a stand, which kind of takes that last phrase, what we do determines who we are. It just shattered barriers on campus because there was a safe place for this man to sort of deal with that. Incredibly risky thing, not tenured. It's one thing to say things after you've been tenured, they can't throw you out, but, well, they can, but it's a little bit harder to do. But for an untenured faculty member to make that sort of statement. So our campus has been sort of an interesting hotbed of, for a little Norwegian campus in the middle of South Dakota, I think courageously has taken on some controversial issues, and people have taken stands. There was a lot of conversation, some of it heated, by their faculty who felt very differently. But for the first time that I've been there in Augustana's history in the last 6 years, it was conversation that seemed to try to cross some of those boundaries instead of simply labeling. Well, there are a bunch of conservative people over in the business and government department, and they don't like gay and lesbians, and then there's the liberal people over in the English and religion department. There were some strange conversations that started happening. An attempt to try to listen to how the other person felt. And interesting enough, it rose out of those safe zone kind of sticker things. Other comments or questions? Yeah, Karen?
And I think getting back to the first two points you raised there, there was a kind of microcosm of that happening yesterday morning here during the Bible study. And it had to do with the Bible study that was focused on Abraham and Sarah and Hagar. And some of us who, you know, I think our natural propensity as white people is to read it through Abraham and Sarah. And yet some of us couldn't help but speak up because we've been impacted by listening to especially African-American women who've really shaken us to a realization that, and for whom Hagar has become kind of a jumping off point for a whole new perspective of African-American women doing theology. And the kind of uneasiness that it was interesting because I was sitting up there, I happened to mention that, and I had all these people come up to me afterwards because it was, where you stand determines what you see. Certainly, that's true with lots of biblical texts.
Yeah.
But it was just something that happened yesterday in this room that I think illustrates your point.
That's a good example because I think the biblical texts. We had a little twist on that last week when Eric Eliason was here doing poetry. He had one section on sort of looking at biblical figures through different lenses. And one poem was on Salome, where she danced before the king for the beheading of John the Baptist. And this poem was from the perspective of Salome, sort of condemning John the Baptist, saying, you know, you spent a lot of time exhorting and preaching to the men, but you never once came to me to preach, to think that I was even worthy of a brain, and the only thing I've been trained to do is to dance before the men. So it was this strange turn of listening to the voice of Salome, and I'll never hear that text the same again. It's a little bit that same sort of thing. Other voices bring a perspective that, and of course, that's what Kathleen Norris is talking about. It's a conversion experience. You will never hear the text of Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar again. And probably that group who sat and listened to that comment will always have that planted in their head.
I recommend that everybody read at least one book on that subject. Joyce Holliday's Clothed with the Sun is an awfully good one. It takes the women in the Bible and reveals what they're thinking, what they're saying. What's my name? A Weems? A woman? What's her name?
Winita.
Weems has another one on women in the Bible. Okay. Her story, is that the same?
And Dolores Williams has in the Wilderness.
Okay. And it really reveals an awful lot when you turn it around and take a look at it through these women who sometimes are just obscurely just glossed over in whatever Bible verse it is. It sure woke me up.
Yeah. Those are good comments. There's all kinds of ways to access different viewpoints. And I think you do literally become sort of converted or turned around. Your stance moves, doesn't it? Because you can't see through the eyes any longer of where you've been. And where you've been always comes with you. But when you look through those new eyes, I think you change direction. I spent the whole afternoon, I always do dumb things like order books for students to use in class and then I haven't read it yet. So I spent the whole afternoon reading this wonderful collection of essays called Freeing Theology, edited by Catherine Lacunia, and it's a whole essay after essay taking doctrines in the church from the Roman Catholic, from a feminist Roman Catholic perspective. And I've read feminist theology for years. But this is again it's looking through the eyes and several times thinking, God, I had never thought of it that way. There's a wonderful essay in here on the Eucharist. And I will never again sort of certain things that just really hit home. So I think your example is wonderful, and so is Karen's, of places and times. It goes back to that Matthew text of looking through the eyes of the other and how that becomes a conversion experience for faith. It becomes a way of opening up one's faith. It actually produces possibility and promise. Other comments? Tomorrow, we're going to spend some time, you might think about if you come or bring anybody with you, about sort of, we'll take a little bit of time with just sort of anecdotes. I've thought of a few in my age, about how sacramental practices, what they can do to a church community. Very simply, when I was on internship, the church was trying to decide whether to table communion, the 12 go up at a time and kneel, or whether we would have, as they called it, something like roundabout. I mean, they had made up some sort of the way the Catholics do it. And our whole annual meeting in that year was spent going over and over and over this communion practice issue, and we finally decided to do it, the continual communion, and about 50 people left the congregation. So it was, you know, that was just one little piece of the history of that congregation, but I find that that's important because that's an important description, because there's a little phrase, lex orandi, lex credendi. Out of the practice of faith comes belief. Why do we only have communion once a week and once a month in a lot of these Norwegian churches out in the Midwest? Well, it partly had to do with how often the preacher got there. I mean, it wasn't just that we didn't want to be Catholic or whatever, but it has in part to do with how the practice of the faith results in belief. You find yourself doing something and then asking why. So we're going to look at that tomorrow, about how practice has led to the beliefs about the sacraments, do a little typology that's been helpful for me at sort of looking at major traditions within the faith, and spend a little bit of time just on a little short paragraph that I think Rolvag captures. Maybe you remember he was talking to Tom Barola about the nature of the church. It's in about the middle of the book, and how the church has missed its calling. So we'll take a little bit of time with that to look about the nature of the body of Christ and its brokenness and how we begin to heal from that. So we'll see you tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you.